Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Takeout ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
But who's counting, right?
And his name is Major.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
Please welcome Major Garrett.
From the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's The Takeout.
This is a major achievement.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major Garrett. Yes, CBS. Yes, hi.
Major Garrett.
Major, that's nonsense. And you should know better.
Is Major out of the doghouse?
The answer is yes.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. This is The Takeout. Happy to be back in New York City. We are just off Times Square. Carnegie Diner is our host restaurant. First time we've been here. I dig the vibe. We'll be back, I'm pretty sure. This show has got a very simple title. Anthony Mason's Greatest Hits. Anthony Mason, a beloved, cherished colleague of mine at CBS. He has carved out a place in journalism that is distinct, important, and meaningful to millions of Americans. What is that place? Musicians, music, and the artistry behind it. Anthony Mason, great to see you. Thanks for being with me.
Welcome to New York. It's nice to have you.
You're a native, aren't you?
I am a native New Yorker. I love it.
You're a native on two ways. A CBS native your entire career, either affiliate stations or the network.
I had 2 years in an NBC affiliate way back in,
we don't speak of
Stone Age. Yeah.
We don't speak of that.
But no, like 40, I try not to count.
A CBS native and a New York native.
Yeah.
You love New York City.
Yeah, I do. I was born and grew up here. I left, you know, for CBS assignments over the years. But and it's always a love. If you're a New Yorker, it's a love-hate thing. So this city, you know, has a way of, if you're down, it can crush you, you know, and that's a very distinct feeling. But if you're up, you're as high as you can be,
right?
You know, and that's what I've always loved about it.
I want to ask you first, how did you carve out this space? Because you did lots of other really important, cool things in journalism before you gravitated toward music and this now convening authority that I don't think is equaled in the industry.
It was.
You can bring people to the microphone that almost no one else can.
Well, I think what, first of all, it was entirely an accident.
Okay. Sometimes the best things in life are.
Yeah, it was literally, I was walking up 10th Avenue here a couple blocks over one afternoon, and I bumped into a cameraman of ours who works for Sunday Morning named Ron Dean. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm shooting a piece on Patti Scialfa, who is Bruce Springsteen's wife and a singer in her own right, a really great one. And I was like, well, damn, I have both of her albums, and I wish I was doing that, you know? And so I started thinking, and I went to a producer at Sunday, and I said, well, you know, what's the deal? And they said, well, we're doing Patty, and then we'll probably do Bruce. And I said, who's doing that?
Right.
And they said, how about you?
Okay.
And I was like, you're kidding, right? And they're like, no, we don't have anybody. You could do it. And that was literally the beginning. I did that, and I was like, I loved it.
So you started with the boss.
I started about as big as you could get,
right,
at least in my head.
And at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I mean, you couldn't have, and that second piece I did was Neil Diamond, which, you know, which those were like, as a kid, those were like my two idols,
right,
in music. So I was sort of off and running, and I was like, how do I do more of this? And there wasn't a lane for it,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Right.
There was no lane. And So I kind of started doing it on the sly. It was almost a subversive thing. You know,
some of the best things in life are subversive.
You know, what happened, Major, was I was the business correspondent. Right. I wore a suit and tie every day, and that's how people saw me.
Right.
But that was really kind of a costume, you know? It really was. And
what, costumes on television?
Yeah, but, it's like also when you're walking into a big firm, you know, you want them to know that you can dress as well as they can because they're looking very powerful. But so people were like, when I started doing music pieces, people were like, wait a minute, what do you know about music? And I'm like, same as you. I mean, I grew up with it. I have it in my head all the time. I love it. What, you know, and, but I really, I had to sort of, luckily I had a producer at the time who was like, you should be doing this. Mm-hmm. And so he would cover for me when I went off and did one of these pieces for Sunday. And the more I did them, the more I realized how much I related to artists. Mm-hmm. I was taking a walk with my wife on the beach a couple of weekends ago, and we were talking about some stuff, and she said, you always thought that your people were journalists. And she said, then you discovered that your people were artists.
Your people are artists.
And I was like, okay, I think I probably knew that, but it hasn't been said out loud. And it's basically true. My mother married my stepfather when I turned 7. And he was a painter.
Okay.
So we moved into a house with an artist. And my mother was an interior decorator. So it was an incredibly visually stimulating place. So I saw the whole creative process in front of me, even though I never really participated in it. And it influenced me enormously in ways I didn't understand for literally decades.
Right.
But so what I tapped into when I started interviewing musicians was all of that. And it allowed me to ask questions essentially about my stepfather in an abstract way to other people, and later to ask questions about myself to other people who'd been through the whole thing. So it was, what I later realized was, it was actually a very personal journey. And I think what artists related to in time, as I figured this out, was I wasn't there because of their celebrity. I was there because I was interested in how they made their music, or how they painted a picture, or that was the first thing I was interested in.
And they responded to that, and then other artists saw what that looked like and were more inclined to say yes if you called.
Well, you know what this business is like. When you call up someone who's famous and say, I want a day and a half of your time, they laugh at you in the phone. And they'll go, you get 20 minutes in a hotel room on Fifth Avenue, you know, if you're lucky. And what we realized early on was, you can't make a great piece like that. You're basically making radio, but with a camera.
Right.
And you have to have a spectacular interview, which, if it's a person who never talks,
then
it's worthwhile. But so what we started saying was, no, let's go somewhere that's meaningful to you, and let's spend time there. And what you get then is that the celebrity forgets they're a celebrity, and they become the kid that they were when they grew up, with all of those insecurities or whatever kind of suddenly rising to the top. Mm-hmm. And the first example for that with me was with Neil Diamond.
Right.
When we took him, the first piece I did, which I think was 2005, and we went back to the bitter end where Neil had played his first show.
Right.
And we walked in, and Neil's entire body language changed. It's like he'd been sort of tense, but very nice. But all of a sudden, his whole body relaxed, and he went through it. He went through a time tunnel, you know, and he became. He started looking around the room, trying to piece it all back together. And I'd lost at that point. I lost Neil Diamond, the celebrity, and I got Neil Diamond, the kid.
Which is the magic of it all.
That's the magic. And, you know, and he found the hall at the back of the room where he'd been, and he opened the door and he goes, is this it? This is it.
Right.
This is the place. I said, what happened here? He goes, it's where I got my first $50 for the first performance I ever had.
Right.
It's the moment I was a professional.
So the key is to get them, whoever it is, outside of the hardened tunnel of PR and celebrity dome.
Yeah, that's what you're hoping for. And you have to convince people of your sincerity, you know, which is, I'm not here because if I put you in the tees at the top of my show, a lot of people are going to watch, you know, and they are. But if you talk about how you, you know, wrote a particular song, or where your music comes from.
Right.
That's ultimately the conversation that every artist wants to have.
So I'm curious, did you gravitate toward business originally because that's what drives New York City? And to feel like you were connected to this big city and journalistically relevant, business was the place to go?
I think I did it, if I'm honest. There, in my family, there's the artistic side and there's the business side.
Okay.
My brother was an investment banker.
Okay.
My father started a mutual fund back in the 60s.
Then an innovator. Those were not common.
Right. And that they have that side of the brain.
Right.
What I realized later was I have more like my mother, and obviously my stepfather is in blood, but I was like, oh, I actually relate to this guy. But I think in some ways, two things happened. One, my father-in-law, we were sitting in a pool in the middle of the summer, and he was complaining about how business was being covered. And I thought, you know, you're right. This side of things never gets shown. The pressure to provide jobs, create jobs, sustain jobs, all that kind of stuff. We always look at it from the company is bad and the worker is great, and it's more complicated than that.
More complicated.
And I thought, okay, there's an opportunity to do something there that hasn't been done, and it's visually challenging because money other than a dollar bill doesn't photograph.
Right.
And so that was why I wanted to do it, those two things. But I never expected to do it as long as I did.
That is the voice of Anthony Mason, the show title, Anthony Mason's Greatest Hits. We are just getting started. Carnegie Diner is our host restaurant. We thank them. Back for segment two, the takeout in just 1 second.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Carnegie Diner, our host restaurant. Breakfast, my breakfast is on the way, so is Anthony's. His will be a little bit smaller, more modest. Mine will be kind of reckless, I guarantee you. So, you talked about Neil Diamond. You did two interviews with Neil Diamond.
I've done, actually, I think about six over the years. But
okay,
yeah.
But two that are, there's that first one going back to Brooklyn, going back to the high school, and the first club he played, and then the most recent one, which continues to be played on almost a daily basis on YouTube. People are fascinated by the story, the tenderness, and the heartbreak of where Neil Diamond finds himself.
Well,
now,
you and I are both Neil Diamond fans.
I'm an unapologetic Neil Diamond fan.
No, and you have nothing to apologize for.
The first two albums of my life were Neil Diamond albums, and I've loved him ever since I was about 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah. So one of, I mean,
beautiful songwriter.
Terrific songwriter. Great voice. When I was a kid, I used to think, well, if I could sing, and I can't, I would sound like Neil Diamond.
Right.
That's what
me
I
too.
Want.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to sound like. Not even close. But so Neil, I mean, I did that piece with Neil. It was really, I learned a lot just from doing it, as I said. And I've interviewed him a bunch of times over the years, and I was always, I'm always interested when you get these older artists, artists as they age, they continue touring, because it's very grueling.
Yes.
I don't care how much money you have, how many buses you have, you're still staying in hotels, you still have this, you know, adrenaline high and crash, and I was like, you know, why, you don't need to do this. Why do you do this? And he, that was another interview. And he sort of stopped and he goes, I do need to do it. And I don't know why.
I don't know why.
Yeah. And so when he retired after he got Parkinson's, I was like, this has to be really hard for him. And I really felt for him as I thought about it. you know, for someone who so much of their identity came from. And if you see the Broadway musical.
Yes, which I have.
Yeah, but which, by the way, which touches on a lot of these things. It's very moving, especially that part of it. And I recommend it to folks. But so I was like, I was really hoping I would get the chance to talk to him about it someday. And that came earlier this year. And, you know, he was in an extraordinary place because he basically, he said it had taken him a long time. I mean, it had really only been, I think, in recent weeks that he accepted, you know, the condition that he was in and that this was it. It wasn't going to get better.
Yeah.
And it was, I'm increasingly fascinated with the arc of an artist's life.
Right.
And how they approach the end of it, you know, and what their own, you know, do they feel they've succeeded?
Right.
What's important to them?
Are they still chasing something?
Are they chasing something? Does legacy matter?
You right. know, these what is validation? How does it come?
What is
how
it
do
mean?
You measure it?
Yep. And
because it's not record sales.
No.
I see it over and over again.
No.
You say, well, you sold, and they're like, I'm still searching. I'm still reaching.
Yeah.
It's not, you would think that might be one. It's not that.
No, I was down with Barry Gibb a few weeks ago in Miami because Barry's getting he's a Kennedy Center honoree.
He is a Kennedy Center honoree this year.
And I said, does legacy matter to you? And he said, nope. He said, I don't care what you think of me once I'm gone.
Okay.
He said, my goal is, you know, the beauty of being a songwriter is the song gets remembered.
Right.
You know, and I don't care what you think about me.
Right.
Or the Bee Gees. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. You know, I mean, because, and a lot of these guys, you know, for whatever, their physical things that are starting to happen. Paul Simon, who we also talked to this year,
right.
you know, is having hearing problems and can't really play with a group of musicians anymore, which is really hard. You know, this is how these guys have defined themselves. So, you know, it's so interesting to see an artist when they are blossoming in the beginning. You know, and also at the end, how they're dealing with whatever failure and success they may have had in their lives.
Talk about blossoming. You talked to a blossoming Adele.
Yeah, that was a wild moment. It's 15 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the tape. I don't know, in the middle of the summer, because I was working on a project, and I said, I called the guy to help me produce it. And I said, there is so much. It was before she was known in America.
Right. She was a UK phenomenon.
She was breaking out in the UK. No one in America heard who she was, knew who she was. And I had seen her on YouTube in a clip, and I was like, whoa.
Right.
And I threw her in on a package of stories I was doing for Sunday morning over in London. And I said, do you mind if we do this piece too? And they're like, yeah, okay, fine. And we ended up spending, it was like two full days with Adele, you know, because, you know, literally one of the things I saw in the footage that I didn't even remember. It's so funny what you forget.
Right.
At one point, she was on 8th Avenue across from Madison Square Garden.
Right.
She was going to an office tower to basically sing for a radio station, you know, which she did in a conference room, you know, sitting in a chair. You know, and blew the roof off the place. But she was standing across the street, and she looked up and she goes, what's that? And her publicist goes, that's Madison Square Garden. And she goes, oh. And he goes, that's the biggest arena in New York. And she said, how many seats? And he said, about 20,000. And she goes, oh, well, I'll never fill that. And of course, I think it was like 3 years later, she sold out six nights.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, you never know.
Right.
I mean, I would love to tell you I knew. I didn't know.
Exactly.
I had a gut feeling, but I didn't know. And
what's also precious, and I mean that in a very loving way about that piece, is her frantic texting with her then boyfriend.
Yeah.
And she's the one who's wondering when the next text will come. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, why isn't the guy being the one thinking, Adele going to talk to me?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, exactly. I mean, she was a kid. She was, and you feel it. And literally, I'd said to the cameraman, a guy named Nick Turner in London, and I said, Nick, I said, I don't know if
the
you noticed.
The great Nick Turner.
Yes, I said, Nick, I don't know if you noticed, but every time she's not with us, she's sitting in a car or, hiding around the corner texting her boyfriend, see if you can catch it. And he did. And when he did, she burst out laughing in embarrassment. It was really cute.
we were talking about this via email before we sat down, and you said one interview in particular changed the way you approach these. Pharrell Williams.
It was Pharrell, and I think what I recognized that we this was at Pharrell at the peak of everything. It was Happy had exploded. He'd done Blurred Lines with Robin Thicke. He also done a song with Daft Punk that summer. So all of a sudden, this guy who had been a very successful producer and songwriter behind the scenes was in front of everybody.
Right.
And we got offered a shot to talk to him. But they had like no. It was one of those. We'll give you half an hour in a hotel room. And my producer was like, I don't think we should do it. We're not getting the kind of access we typically want. And I said, everybody's talking about Pharrell. Everybody knows what he looks like. Everybody knows the Mountie hat. I said, I can't think I've ever seen him. I don't think I've ever seen him talk. So the talking
is the thing.
Is the thing. I said, so let's try it and see what we get. And we ended up doing this, and we had this conversation here at Electric Lady Studios in New York, which is one of my favorite places to have a conversation. Pharrell was, he didn't want to take credit for anything. And I kept sort of pushing him, not because I thought he was.
It blows me away. The music teacher, this,
yes,
that.
Yes, he gave everybody credit. He gave every music teacher he'd ever had credit. He wasn't taking any himself. There's part of you that goes, all right, this is really wonderful, but is he really being sincere? Mm-hmm. When your math teacher always used to say, show your work, right? I wanted him to show his work. I wanted to know how he got to this feeling, what led him there. So I kept kind of trying to push him, and he finally looked at me and he goes, are you upset at what I'm saying? Because I keep saying the same thing? And I said, no, I'm not upset. I said, I feel like every artist at some point tries to understand what it is they're actually really good at. And he goes, I think that's when they fail. And I was like, oh, okay.
Now we're getting somewhere.
And the door opened, and all of a sudden he said, he gave me what's, to this day, I feel is probably the best ending of a piece I've ever had, which was in a conversation that extended a little longer, he ended up saying, everybody wants to think it's about them. It's not about you. It's not about the kite. It's about the air. You get lifted up. And it came after this sort of tension in the conversation, which was not anger or argument.
Right.
It was just, I'm trying to get at something. And I learned...
Hold on. Because I got to go to break. But that's a great place to hold the audience. That is a great grabber. Anthony Mason didn't even know he was doing that, setting us up masterfully. Segment 3 of The Takeout with Anthony Mason in just 1 second. Welcome back to The Takeout. Carnegie Diner is our host restaurant. Boy, am I glad to be here. I told you breakfast would soon arrive. I don't know if we can get a picture of this, but this is bacon French toast if you're ever here, folks. And I can tell you it is absolutely spectacular. Gluttonous to be sure, but mighty, mighty tasty. I'll probably have my next meal in about a day and a half.
It looks wonderfully evil.
It most certainly is.
Yeah.
Anthony Mason is our special guest. I've wanted to do this show for a very long time because what we're talking about is not only the process of interviewing, but it's process of artistic revelation. Continue our conversation about Pharrell and what you took from that encounter, how it played out, and that thing, that line. It's not about the kite, it's about the air.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was.
Whoa.
And my producer... Ramon Parkins at Sunday came over to me afterwards and he goes, that was amazing. You got to use that whole thing. And I said, well, it took me a while to get the answer I needed, but I finally got it. And he goes, no, you have to use the whole thing. And so when I went to write it, and you know how television is, we're always confined by time. It's our greatest enemy. So you're trying to cram a lot in. But when I wrote it, I let it run longer than I typically do.
Right.
And then when...
Let it breathe, as we say.
When Ed Givnish, our editor, cut it, he let it run even longer. And I was like, dude, you're taking my time here. And he goes, it needs to be there. And I watched it and I was like, okay, you're right. And what I realized was you were watching Pharrell think aloud.
Mm-hmm.
You were watching him think in real time.
Yeah.
It was not an answer he rehearsed. And... Because
he did not come there to say that.
No, he didn't. And consequently, you saw what I always try to find in a conversation is what I think of as a genuine moment. Mm-hmm. When something really pure comes out of a person, it can be show a vulnerability, it can show an honesty, it can show whatever, but it's that moment when you look and go, oh, that's what they're really like. And so what I realized was, if you can often tell a person's character by the way they respond to one thing.
Right.
And I was like, okay, don't try to cram so much in a story anymore. If you have a moment like this, let it breathe so we can feel it, mm-hmm. so we can see how this person thinks in a moment where they're there without wires, if you will, you know? Because so many people who are celebrities or famous or, exposed enormously, mm-hmm. they kind of protect themselves, and understandably so.
They have to.
And so for you to reach them, you have to create a trust. They have to understand that you're not out to embarrass them. You're out to understand how and why they do what they do. And sometimes that takes a while in the course of a conversation. But, you know, then if you get that, then you have the opportunity, you know, to get moments where something is really honest.
Right. And when another artist sees that, then they say, okay.
Yeah.
I'm more likely, if that call ever comes, to be more receptive and possibly more trusting.
Well,
which is how it builds this convening authority that I talked about.
Those are the stories that I remember. Mm-hmm. And the conversation I always have with publicists or management of artists is, right. Look, you can do 20 interviews if you want. Mm-hmm. But if only one of them is memorable, that's the one that's going to travel. And, you know, just putting your face out there doesn't... You want something that, you know, it's always our you know, we always talk about it. You talk about the takeout. We talk about what's the takeaway? You know, what's the takeaway?
Right.
Do you walk away with something that lives on in your head? Because then the story has a life past what you just saw on television. And that's what I'm always aiming for, is I want to find a moment here where I feel like we have captured some part of the essence of this person in this video.
Right. And you recently were with the Stones.
Yeah, which is crazy. I mean,
to see Keith and Mick.
Yeah.
Still with evident, not just satisfaction, to use a word familiar to Stones fans, but joy. They are still thoroughly enjoying this.
They had a promotional concert, a 40-minute one, that I think it was the night before the album came out. It was in a club down here, down the street, and I think there were 250 people in the room. So I got to do something I've never had been able to do in my life, which was actually see Mick Jagger, you know, like 20 feet away. The man is in exceptional shape.
Yeah.
He didn't stop moving for 40 minutes. There's not an ounce of fat on him. And he's 80 years old.
Yeah.
And you just go.
And very nonchalant about turning 80.
Yep. And, I think it means a lot to him that he looks this good and he's 80.
Okay.
I mean, I got that sense. But he works, you can tell he works really hard at it. Mm-hmm. But I was like, okay, I am seeing an older version of the same Stones who would have played in a club in London in the 60s.
Right.
It's the same energy.
And back to where we started, they wanted to create new music. They wrote a new album.
Yeah.
They have nothing, they have zero to prove to anyone.
No.
In this or any other universe.
I think that's the thing with artists is, and I think this isn't just super successful ones, it's almost all artists, is they kind of live to make things. Mm-hmm. You know, and if they're not making things... My stepfather, who was a painter, painted until he was about 87. And some of those years, those last years, he painted some of the best stuff he's ever done. Because all of the stuff that you work at through the course of your life has a cumulative... Mm-hmm. I remember asking Springsteen once, he seemed so old and he was like in his 50s. I was like,
what a puppy.
I know. I said, do you feel like you're a better songwriter now? And he goes, I don't know if I'm better. He said, but I'm wiser. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, it's like we spend all these years learning how to make something, how to make a piece, right. Which to me, I've always liked, to me, pieces were always my songs. That's the way I viewed them, you know, and they had to, and I'm still learning how to do it, mm-hmm. you know, so...
So you've probably gotten this question before, but I really want to know, is there anyone you have yet to interview? Is there a white whale out there?
Dylan is the elusive shadow in the. I don't think that.
Bob, I know you watch.
Yeah,
you're a huge fan of the show. I mean, we all know this.
I don't.
Take Anthony up on it.
I really please. I don't expect that to happen, but there's always, mm-hmm. And the guy I wished I'd had a chance to interview was James Brown, because I thought he was, still maybe the most amazing performer ever. Up there with, Prince is up there, but, as I remember, my son went into a phase where he was really interested in Michael Jackson, and I said, okay, we're going backwards now. Right. I'm going to show you James Brown, peak James Brown, like 64.
Right.
And he looked at it and he was like, whoa. I said, yes. Yeah. Everything comes from something else.
Yes.
It's all aligned. And that's the other thing that's interesting about music, is it's all connected in some way. It's all... And exploring those
Remember the chalkboard and School of Rock?
Yeah.
Okay? Go back to it. You can find it on the web. It's really cool. Everything's connected.
It's all connected. And the artists all know that. Mm-hmm. So when they sit there, it's like Willie Nelson, getting in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And you're like, but he's a country singer. But...
Right.
But his favorite singer is Frank Sinatra. So it is all connected.
Do you ever wish you could have interviewed the chairman of the board?
Oh, absolutely. I still have play Sinatra albums all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, for my money, the best male singer of my lifetime.
I agree. Aretha's
the best female singer.
I agree.
I just think in terms of styling and inflection, nobody...
And taking the words, rising and falling with the melody, picking up the tempo, slowing it down, raising the voice, bringing it down, the whisper, all of that.
Yep.
So obviously not effortless and not natural, but sounding effortless and sounding so natural.
He's, and he also had a whole bunch of different chapters, which was really interesting. I mean, the Nelson Riddle years were my favorite. But I will say I was sort of a late comer to Tony Bennett, who I have an enormous appreciation for. Tony had a way where he could sing a song. I remember I saw him. It was the night he was doing a show with Gaga in Lincoln Center down here, and he came out by himself. Gaga was changing costumes, and he sang a song called "How Do You Keep the Music Playing," which was a song that it was a movie song. The original version was pretty good, but it was like Tony was talking to you when he sang. You weren't aware that he was singing. It just flowed so naturally, and I was like, that's what a great singer is.
That's what a great singer is. That's the voice of Anthony Mason. We are at Carnegie Diner. I am so enjoying my breakfast. Segment 4 coming your way ever so shortly.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a house. It's your home, the place that's filled with memories. The early days of figuring it out, to the later years of still figuring it out. For the place you've put down roots, trust Amica Home Insurance. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome back to Carnegie Diner. I am so thoroughly enjoying my bacon French toast. Yes, I know there's a fruit cup. I'm not ignoring the fruit
Standing
cup.
Standing here completely unattended.
I will get to it in due course. Anthony Mason is our ever so special guest. Anthony, I want to talk to you a little bit about, because you had a journalistic career, deeply enmeshed in business economics. How has the business of music changed, and what does it mean to consumers how the business of music has changed?
Well, I think it's gotten easier for consumers in so many ways.
Right.
I mean, you had to work pretty hard to find artists when we were kids, mm-hmm. and So in that sense, I, as a consumer, I love it because I can go down rabbit holes on, you know, if you like this artist, you'll like that artist for hours.
Right.
In ways you couldn't unless, you know, a friend would, you know.
Right.
When I was a kid, it would
be
a
all
friend,
word of mouth.
It was all word of mouth. Friend go, give you an album, say, you got to listen to
this. Or payola at the radio station.
Or payola at the radio station. And
meaning, here's cash, play this record.
So in that sense, you know, stuff can fly around.
It's more democratized.
Way
small
more democratized.
D.
That said,
does it make it harder for artists or easier to make money to survive?
Well, the fact of the matter is you can get heard in ways you couldn't before because they were gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the problem is making money off of that has become much more difficult. And the pressure is, you know, it's primarily a touring business, so you have to build up a body of work that you can travel. And even then, touring is expensive. You know, and I mean, to be honest with you, every time I look at it, I'm like, I don't know, understand how anybody makes money. But I mean, like, they joke about T-shirt sales, but merch is a big deal for a lot of these, you know, sort of emerging artists. It's really where they make, you know, the money
it's
that
where
they
the margin live. Comes.
Yeah, it's where the margin is. And, you know, the whole streaming thing has been good for the record labels, and it kind of saved the business, which was really in, mm-hmm. you know, in free fall for a while. But it hasn't been good for the artists. Because they make pennies.
Pennies.
Pennies. And, I mean, you'd be staggered at, you know, you have to be Taylor Swift to really get a decent check from streaming, as opposed to, you know, in the days when if you sold, you know, a million albums, you know, you were making tons of dough.
Right.
And
a million streams is not the same, not even
no,
close.
No, it literally is pennies. I mean, pennies. You can, I mean, a lot of artists occasionally, you know, post their
right.
streaming checks, and you're just, it's painful.
So talk to me about the Taylor Swift phenomenon. How would you rate the relationship she has with her fans, her particular approach to not only recording, but then re-recording her music?
I think one of the things that's especially interesting about Taylor is just what you said, her relationship with her fans. Mm-hmm. And that is something that's a phenomenon of the contemporary age and social media. Because artists in this era can bypass all the obstacles that there were between you and your fans. And someone like Taylor, who has a really powerful relationship with her audience, can use that in extraordinary ways. And that's why she's been able to go out and re-record her stuff and take ownership of it back. And the audience has been behind her the whole way. There's no way you could have done that 20 years ago or more.
Right.
It just wouldn't have. It wouldn't have happened. And that's, you know, you wonder what the, you know, if the Beatles could have done that,
right.
you know, what would have happened? Because she's the same kind of phenomenon. You know, to me, it's the closest thing you've got. Her and Beyonce.
There is a Taylor Swift economy, I've read.
Yeah, there is. Because people, you know, if she's traveling through a town, you know.
Thousands
of people come in and stay in hotels and buy stuff and everything. Yeah. Yeah. She's amazing.
And you recently talked to Barry Gibb.
Mm-hmm.
That's a conversation about artistry. It's about songwriting. But it's also about loss.
It's. I mean, I met Barry about probably like a dozen years ago, and he was. I interviewed Barry and Robin Gibb. Morris had died, and I think it was 2003. Robin was still with us at that point, and there was clearly some tension between the two of them when I was with them. I mean, it wasn't overt, but you just sort of felt it underneath. I've interviewed Barry, I think, now six times. And each time he's been at a different place, it's very interesting. It's one of the reasons I love. First of all, he's just a lovely man, and really easy to talk to. But his emotionally, he's progressed. In every conversation I've had with him, he's become more and more reflective, and has processed all of this stuff. It took him a long time to process losing his brothers, partly because he wasn't in a great place with either one of them when they died. I mean, Andy died, you know, the youngest brother was not in the Bee Gees, died back in the 80s. But Robin died in 2013, I think, or 2012, and Morris in 2003. And, you know, and it was, you know, this is a guy who had always gone on stage with his two brothers. He'd never gone down there alone. And we did, when he did his first solo tour, we went up to Boston to meet him there. And, you know, I think it was, I think it was really complicated, you know, because he'd been defined by those relationships. But at the same time, he wanted to be seen for himself. So one of the things that Barry says is that when he played Glastonbury in 2017 solo, and there were hundreds of that, literally over, I think, 100,000 people there, maybe more, and the reaction, he said it was literally the best moment of my life in terms of music.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a fan of Anthony Mason, as I am, there's a burning question that needs to be asked. Anthony Mason, are you going to write a book?
That's a cheap trick. I'm working on one. It's as you can imagine, and I mean, you've written 5 books. And as you were telling me before our breakfast came, that every time you write one, you promise you'll never write one again. I wrote 3 chapters and was like, I'm done. It's like, I really want to. It's what I'm working on is a book that's sort of partly a memoir, but also really a book about creativity and the way all these artists that I've talked to over the years approach it. Mm-hmm. And it's the one of the things that's so great about music is you can never really fully answer where a song came from. That question never gets a definitive resolution.
Or, in some cases, what the song means.
Exactly.
It means a different thing to a different person,
right,
in a different stage of their life.
Not only that, but artists will tell you that a song that they wrote, you know, in this year, 10 years later, means something different to them.
To them.
Or they see something in it about themselves that they didn't even recognize them before. So it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, I spent time, we did a piece early, a few weeks, actually about a month ago, writing a song in Nashville with a couple of people.
We're going to talk about that in the Especial.
And that was, as much as I, you know, I've interviewed people about the process, actually being part of it was really eye-opening, because it's this thing that people talk about. I remember Mick Jagger talked about it, Paul Simon talked about it, this idea that, you know, one minute there's nothing there, and the next minute there's this song out here, you know, and where does that come from?
Right.
And it is, I mean, we walked out with a song after 3.5 hours, and it's on my phone, and I can play it whenever I want. And every time I do, I'm just like, okay, I understood that this was kind of magic, but I never really understood it like I do now.
That is a great way to say this part of the program is over, but I urge you, because you're going to want to hear more about that process and Anthony Mason's song and the Takeout Outtake Especial. That's next. We'll see you next week. Our thanks again to the Carnegie Diner here in New York City. Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial, coming to you from just off Times Square in New York City. Carnegie Diner. What a great breakfast I've had. Anthony Mason is our special guest. Anthony, and you can watch this piece on YouTube, folks. It's a masterful, beautiful. I must tell you, as a colleague and a friend of yours, I got very emotional watching this piece about your songwriting process and what came out of you, what you discovered. I was your journey. I'm not trying to appropriate it at all, but I was emotionally wrapped up in it at a very surprising and deep level.
I think that's one of the things that was interesting about the story when it aired was how, I mean, so many people said, you know, I was crying in the middle of this song.
Yep.
And this is something, this came about because the show has a series called Never Too Late, in which you do something you've always wanted to do but have never done. And I tend to turn my nose up at series for a lot of snotty reasons. But my producer came to me and said, what if you wrote a song? And I said, oh, well, God, I'd love to do that.
Right.
So I reached out to Natalie Hemby, who's a very established and songwriter in Nashville. I just sent her a text. I said, I need to talk to you. And I called her and I said, would you ever be willing to do this? And she said, are you kidding? I would love to do it. So I thought, I said, okay, I don't know when this is. Yeah, I said, I don't know when this is happening, but let's just start thinking. So she brought in Mike Elizondo. Mike has worked with Eminem. He started out with Dr. Dre in L.A., but now he's in Nashville. Like, he did the Brothers Osborne album. He's an incredibly talented guy with enormous range. So, and I'm smart enough to know, if I'm going to try to write a song, I better do it with 2 ridiculously talented people who might at least help keep me from really embarrassing myself, which I've never liked to do. But truthfully, we went to Nashville. We had booked a 3.5-hour session. And I was like, we'll never write a song in 3.5 hours. How the hell is that going to happen? But they're like, don't worry. We do this for a living. We came in, none of us knew what we were going to do. I had sent them a poem about the ocean that I'd written, that I said, there might be something in here. And Natalie looked at me, and Natalie wrote Rainbow with Casey Musgraves. She wrote Crowded Table with the High Women, is a band she's in. She's written a ton of hits for Miranda Lambert. She also has a beautiful voice. And she said, this is really nice, and I know you love the ocean because I see your Instagram page and you're always posting pictures. She said, but I think this song should be about you.
Not the ocean.
Okay. But about you and the ocean.
Got it. Okay.
And she said, because everybody who I get this a lot, people think they don't want to make it personal because that people won't connect to it. She said, that's actually how people do connect, is when there's something personal in it.
Right.
And so we sort of shifted our focus, and we ended up in three. We had a chorus in about 45 minutes, and we all looked at each other and we're like, this is actually good. And so we kept going, and by the end, we had a song. And Natalie came with this exquisite little melody that she and Mike sort of massaged and pulled out, and it's really beautiful. And we were really lucky, and Natalie and Mike would probably both tell you that, because some days you go in and you get, I thought we'd come out with scraps.
Right.
I thought I'd be, you know, I'd play like, you know, two phrases, and we go, well, we came close, but... But we had
a
song.
That's what you got.
That's what we got. And I was like, this is amazing. Because it didn't exist 3.5 hours earlier.
Right.
You know?
And for those who might be listening, wondering, do you start with a chorus? Is that...
We literally started with...
A means by which songwriters build out, or...
What Natalie did was, so we had this conversation first, and we talked about what we wanted the song to be. And once we decided, you know, it's a love song to the ocean, essentially. Then Natalie said, well, I have this little melody. And she... you know, sang a phrase, which was just kind of a throw-out phrase. But it sounded really pretty. And we were like, okay, let's follow that. So you follow a string, or you pull a string, either one. And that's what happened. And we ended up coming up with some pretty cool lines. Everybody threw in a piece. Natalie was really the engine for this whole thing, because she... I mean, about halfway through, I was like, where are we? What line are we looking for? I'm totally lost. But she was like, we need this, we're really close, you know, and this is working. And so being in the middle of that, because I'd always wondered about the Nashville songwriting process, which is, you know, three, sometimes four people in a room, and in some cases, they don't even know each other. And I'm like, how do you write a song?
Right.
But it's, they have a conversation about something they care about, or that's bothering them, and they'll work it into a thing. And sometimes it is something, and sometimes it's not.
Do you help someone else records it?
I would love for Natalie to record it, but that's, you know, that's up to Natalie.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I have it on my phone, so I'm fine.
Right.
I mean, I'm like, I said it when I'm done. I said, Natalie, I know what they're going to sing at my funeral now. That's good. I don't need anything else other than that. You know, I hope it happens. You know, it's a long way off, but I hope you're still around so you can come sing it. But that's, you know, I just wanted to... I wanted to see the architecture. That's what I wanted to see.
Right.
And I never expected it would turn out to be as special as it did.
That's great. So we have three questions we ask everybody. Most influential book in your life?
Oof.
Favorite movie, or one of your all-time
favorite movie? My kids would tell you in a heartbeat.
And you're really going to enjoy some music, Anthony Mason. I mean, really enjoy it. Who's it going to be?
What order do I do this in?
Any order you wish.
Okay, favorite movie of all time is Chinatown.
Chinatown.
Yeah. And if I'm bored on a flight and I don't know what to watch, Chinatown.
Phenomenal movie.
Favorite music? God, I listen to everything.
Obviously.
But I would probably, it's probably Springsteen.
Springsteen.
Yeah, I mean, I always go back to him at some point.
We're going into our eighth year. Springsteen and U2 are the most often mentioned.
Yeah, I know, I hate to be sort of predictable, but I'm too... And then my favorite book? I mean, the most influential book that I read. Wow. I have to think about that. I think this is a weird choice. In terms of what I do now, there's a book called Mansion on the Hill by, I think, Fred Goodman, I want to say, is the author's name. If I get that wrong, I'm sorry. It was about the music business. It's what I think of as still the best music book ever written about the music business. Kind of in the 70s, the 60s and 70s. And it's when I read that I was like, okay, I understand how all of this came together. And And it helped me understand what I wanted to go after in terms of conversations with artists.
Very good. That's the voice of Anthony Mason. What a kick it has been to spend a good long hour with him. Thanks so much, Anthony.
Thank you, Major. It was a treat.
Again, our thanks to Carnegie Diner here right off Times Square. That concludes your Takeout Outtake Especial. We will see you and talk to you next week.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Jake Rosen, and Ashley Armstrong. CBSN production by Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene...
There were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus, starting May 1st.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.